At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
When police conducted a welfare check on a home in Akron, Ohio, they discovered a severely injured Brenda Powell. She was covered in stab wounds and was bleeding out. Sadly, she would later succumb to her injuries. Her hysterical daughter, Sydney, who met the police when they arrived, told them there'd been a break-in. However, upon investigation, all was not as it had seemed. Sydney had been hiding a secret from her family, which had been revealed only moments before the attack. This is what happens when someone would go to extreme lengths to maintain their own distorted version of reality. This is the murder of Brenda Powell. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's crack on with today's case. And I do think it's one that some of you are going to be familiar with, because as I said, it has been all across screens on court TV, and it really has done a deep dive on what's gone on to lead to a situation where a young girl with everything to live for, everything future-wise, that just seems so positive and promising, for it to all come crashing down in the most brutal and tragic and certain of ways to some degree, is something that I think causes confusion for those people looking into this case. So who was Sydney Powell? Well, let's just say there was nothing outstanding about her as a child regarding behaviour that makes you think we're going to be covering a case of murder that we're going to be covering today. Let's just get it out there right now. It's very difficult to see where things truly started to capsize, because to all intents and purposes, she was a pretty special girl. She was very well loved, very supportive and supported environment growing up. She was born to her parents, Brenda and Stephen, in Akron, Ohio. She has a brother, Andrew, really tight-knit family. And Sydney was in particularly meant to be close to her mother. So Stephen, her brother, said, you know what? Mother and daughter had this unbreakable bond. And I'm a mother to sons. I'm also a new mother to a daughter. And even though my boys are my world, I do stick to that old saying, which is a son is a son till he meets a wife, a daughter's a daughter for the rest of her life. I don't know whether that's true. I'm kind of hoping my kids are going to stick around, whatever. But arguably, often mothers and daughters can have a very strong bond and one that lasts a lifetime. So this is what people talk about when they discuss how Sydney was with her mother. Brenda clearly was quite a vocational individual. She was somebody who worked as a child life specialist at Akron's Children's Hospital. And basically that's a family centre for childhood cancer and blood disorders. So she must have been around quite a lot of trauma. And I think it always speaks to somebody's personality and character when they can do jobs like this. She was described by people who know her as the very best of humanity. She was described as caring and selfless. She was also described as incredibly dedicated. She was a really loving and devoted mother. And according to people who knew her, and according to her children, she genuinely was an incredible human being. Her children were meant to be the lights of her life. So Brenda is a huge loss to this world. She's not just a loss vocationally. She's not just a loss socially. She's not just a loss because her family adore her. She's a loss to humanity. Because I always think when a beautiful human being dies, you know, when the world loses somebody in such circumstances, a light goes out in the world that can't be replaced. And also the darkness in the world gets bigger because the balance is disrupted. So she's a really lovely human being. Sydney, her daughter, and the person we're going to concentrate mostly on this case, she, as I said, didn't have an ingredients list that people are looking at the pen portrait of possibility and considering that there's going to be something cataclysmic that occurs in the way that she behaves down the line. As a child, she's considered very charismatic. And I think when we use the word charismatic, we sometimes underestimate what that really means. You know, it's just a word, but it's more than a word. It says that an individual has the X factor. They're somebody who can genuinely light up a room. They're a person who's got that je ne sais quoi about who they are as a human being. And it draws people in. You can't help but be enchanted by an individual who drips in charisma. And Sydney's meant to have that. Also, she was considered really social. She was really bubbly. She did really well in school. And she actually achieved a partially funded presidential scholarship to attend the University of Mount Union. So again, you know academically you're doing really well and that they considered you to have an incredibly bright future when they're stepping in and giving a scholarship. And even though that's partially funded, that will be incredibly difficult to achieve. And Sydney achieved it. So the future is looking bright. I'm sure that everyone around Sydney is incredibly proud of her. She's making her moves in the world and she's succeeding in the world around her. But I also think we can introduce the concept of what it's like as a successful young person to imagine things not working out as you had planned. When children are academic, when they do well in school, and we see this consistently in child psychology, developmentally, a child can thrive brilliantly in academia all the way through till they get to a certain point, and then things can start to collapse. And it's not because the child isn't bright, it's not because the child isn't somebody who can succeed, it's that the variables shift and change when it comes down to studies. So you may go into a course that you think you're going to love, that you've not really spent time on in school or college, and then suddenly you find yourself academically challenged, and that's deeply disconcerting. I can remember one of the most profound yet simple conversations that I ever had with a girl that I went to university with. She was a good friend. She was incredibly beautiful, incredibly bright, and she was one of those people who just seemed to effortlessly float through school and college, etc. And then she failed her driving test. And it seems so minor, but it absolutely meant that she spiraled for a period of time because she had never failed before. And she said, when you're so used to succeeding, a blow like that can seem like nothing to others, but it's everything to you because it disrupts your sense of reality. You suddenly think, maybe the world isn't formed and forged in the way that I believe it's going to be. Maybe I'm going to have problems that I didn't ever believe I'd encounter. And it's very easy when you're on the top of your game to have an impact that makes you feel destabilized, and it changes your worldview. And just to acknowledge that when you're young, those kind of slings and arrows of outrageous fortune can feel really deeply problematic. It's one of the reasons why I love that I failed so well. I mean that with total gratitude. I am one of those people that works harder, goes further, takes more risks, because I'm really good at failure. When you're okay at failing, it means that you're not afraid to try things, and inevitably, in the end, you tend to succeed at something. So I think that failure is a really positive thing to encounter early on if you can get the mindset around resilience to deal with that. But this is just to acknowledge psychologically, it can be really impactful if you've always succeeded and always done well, and the world around you celebrates you in such a manner, and then it starts to crumble. Now, as I said, Sydney's been academically gifted in school, but when she's gone to university, and university is a big different place and space, you're with people that you don't know, you're building new relationships, you're often in a situation where there are other very academic people. So you go from being part of a spectrum where academia measures people who struggle in academia in your class all the way to those who thrive, and you may be at the top of that. You get to academic institutions where it's all about people who've succeeded in their skills in academia. Well, suddenly that spectrum's a lot smaller, and you might have been at the top of your game at school, and you might be mediocre to lower in the class in an academic institution, not because you're not bright, but because that always has to be those who do better than others. It's just the way it works. And she is experiencing this. So she's failing her classes in the second year, and it gets bad. She's suspended at the end of 2019, and you can imagine that for somebody who has thrived and strived and succeeded, this is going to be terrifying for her. And bear in mind, she's had a lovely life up until this point, so she doesn't really have anything to measure that failure against, and she doesn't want to let people down, and it's going to cause her a great amount of psychological distress. Now, if she had been in a scenario where she could have honestly acknowledged it and just had a conversation with people around the fact it's not working out, this is where this story would have ended. But for whatever reason, she's built up such a picture that she needs to succeed, that the consequences, it's too destabilizing to even imagine that this is actually happening to her. And I would say, to some degree, this is where she hopes that she can create a world where none of this is actually happening and where she can just carry on as normal, even though that's completely abnormal to do. So despite this massive change in her circumstances where she's now actually been suspended, she didn't tell her family.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Her friends, what was going on? So it must have been devastating for her. And it also means that she felt that she couldn't actually invest in people around her, because if she invested that truth and dared to trust them with that information, she clearly believed that they would see her as lesser than or not good enough. And again, that's a mismatch with reality. If Sydney had actually asked for help, her parents would have stepped in and helped her. Her brother would have stepped in and helped her. Her friends would have stepped in and helped her. But the isolation that she creates by believing that she cannot have that conversation also is another fracture in her foundation, mental health-wise. Now, she isn't somebody who's used to failing, but I'm not talking about her being arrogant. I'm not talking about her having superiority complexes. I'm saying she doesn't understand how to fail. And when you don't understand how to fail, it can completely destroy your sense of who you are in that moment for a period of time. And unless you have the right variables and support frameworks around you to pick you up and help you recognize that you're just taking things too seriously, there's always second chances, it can feel ultimately like there is no escape. So it's likely she felt a high degree of shame. It's likely that the thought of even daring to talk to people about her predicament was incredibly daunting to her. She goes home for the Christmas with all of this going on in the back of her mind, and she doesn't admit it to her family. She doesn't tell them she's no longer enrolled, and she even goes as far as to return to university in January 2020. She even continues to attend her classes and her sorority meetings. So she is not just hiding from her problems here, she is living a life of lies in the context that she's still attending a place she's suspended from. It demonstrates that she's doing everything in her power to go through the motions in the banal hope that somehow it's going to make this a reality. And to some degree, that introduces us to her, to some degree, breaking from reality. Now, clearly, she doesn't know what she's going to do in the future. Everything that she was working towards is now at risk. So her long-term plan in continuing to do what she's doing is more likely embedded in denial. So if I just continue as if nothing's happened, if I fool the world, then maybe I can fool myself. She doesn't want to face the reality of her situation. She ends up actually being forced to move out of her university accommodation. That's at the end of February. And the reason that she has to do that is her access key actually gets terminated. So this will be a really important moment because it breaks that sense of living in a false reality. Something has been removed from her that makes her step into reality, which is, I can't actually get in to where I'm meant to be sleeping. therefore this is now becoming real, and that's going to increase stress. And we know what stress does. Stress can make us feel very, very fraught. It can also actually lead to higher levels of violence. We see that particularly in male perpetrators. If they're stressed, they're more violent, but equally it'll be the same for women. So stress can be a real activator of a lot of behaviours that ideally we would wish to suppress. She'd also at this point received a written notice of her expulsion, so it's in black and white. She's also had to go through meetings with university officials, but she didn't, in spite of all of this, leave until the absolute moment that she had to. And I find that quite striking as well. I don't know about you guys, but I'm one of those people that if they don't want me, I'm not going to come back. You know, if you were to be in a situation where at work they were like, right, unfortunately, we've got to make some redundancies, so we're going to give you 4 weeks' notice, I'd be like, okay, and I would never go back. I'd be like, I'm out of here. Forget it. I'm leaving right now. I'm not going through that. And the same with this situation. If somebody said, you're not going to be able to carry on your studies here, I wouldn't hang around. So again, denotes that she's just trying to pretend that she doesn't have to ultimately deal with this until she physically, emotionally, socially, and environmentally has to deal with it. Now, bear in mind, in spite of the fact she's now aware that she's had to leave, she's still maintaining to people outside of university that she hasn't actually been suspended. In fact, she even told her roommate, Lauren, that she was just taking a break. She wanted to go and figure things out. And then, as opposed to just acknowledging that this has happened with her family, she ends up paying for hotels just in a bid to keep up the pretense to her parents and to stop her having to go home. And I guess that her home is something that represents an important psychological reality. If she's going home, it's over. If she's going home, she's failed at university. If she's going home, she's admitting defeat. If she's going home, she's having to face and confront the feelings that are really challenging for her, and also to acknowledge that her parents will be aware that she has been lying and also that she's failed. And she doesn't want to deal with that because basically she doesn't want to let them down. And this is not putting any blame on the parents. These are totally normal feelings that young people experience. They, if they come from a loving, supportive environment, don't want to let the people down that love them and provide for them. They see it as a personal failure that's so enormous, and it represents some kind of feeling that's tied to the parents as well, i.e. you will think badly of me because I have not succeeded in spite of what you've provided for me. So all of that psychological weight is going to be hanging on her shoulders. Equally, it's such a shame because Sydney's parents would have been unbelievably supportive. Yes, gonna throw it out there, a little bit annoyed. At the end of the day, you get annoyed, don't you? I remember when my son went through 2 years of college and I knew he wasn't doing any work in his biology A level, and yet he seemed genuinely surprised when he got a U. But at the end of the day, you have a moment where you're like, probably should have done a little bit more work, like I advised. Don't want to come from the parents' manual of, I told you so. But at the end of the day, you have to be like, it's okay, we're going to figure this out. Who cares about you? You didn't want to be a doctor. You don't want to be a biologist. Move on. Concentrate on the grades where you got distinctions and higher grades than that, and then you'll feel better about it. That's the way that parents approach these things. But she's so bought into this, wanting to make it all right and wanting to prevent truth coming out, that now she's even staying in hotels to avoid reality. Now we get to March the 3rd, 2020, and like anything, lies come out. It's a bit of advice that I've got for anybody, particularly if you're younger out there. Whatever you do that's wrong, whatever things are skeleton-based in your cupboard, just tell the people that you love about them. Just admit it, because these things come back and bite you on your ass, and you know what? No lie is ever better than the truth. The truth, when it says will set you free, sets you free. It really does. People can step in and help. You can stop feeling like a terrible human being, and people will be like, you know what? Everybody screws up. It's like the most human that we are. We're all fallible. And I think that for Sydney, if she just had that advice, if she'd just been in a mindset where she could have gone and approached people without having this burden of what she thought people wanted for her, she would have felt relieved of all of this tension. So her dad, Stephen, he attempts to pay Sydney's tuition. Because understandably, they're going to collect the fees from him. She's got a partial scholarship, not a full one. So he notices they haven't been withdrawn from my account. But then he goes to the online portal to figure out what's going on. He can't access it. So He's a bit confused, maybe a little bit suspicious, maybe in the back of his mind has an idea that something untoward is happening. He can't quite figure it out, but he doesn't feel that things are adding up in his head. So whilst he's at work, he's looking at the 360 life tracking app. And when he's doing this, he notices that Sydney's at home. So this is basically a communication app that lets you share locations with one another. But he was like, why is this app showing that Sydney's at home when she shouldn't be home so early in the day? So he's obviously putting two and two together. He's figuring that something's going on. He wants to ask Sydney what on earth is happening. He wants to get to the bottom of it. So he drives home and he asks her what's going on. Now, he actually left his own phone at work because he didn't want Sydney being able to track that he was coming back to the house. So the family must have all known that they use this tracking app, and therefore if she checked and saw that he was en route home, she'd probably leg it. So Stephen confronts Sydney. Initially, she denies that there's any problem. She says, hey, you know what? There's no things going down. Everything's okay. I'm still enrolled at university. But then as they talk, it gets to come to light that she's actually been suspended. She then, totally humanly, talks to her father about the fact that all her friends have got their shit together and that she doesn't. And I think that one of the most human experiences that most of us will endure at some point is we look at people around us and we think, how do they seem so adult? Whereas I am grappling at straws and wondering what the future could be. You know, I'm of the mindset that I haven't even decided what I want to be when I grow up yet. And I think other people's probably think I'm already grown up. There's a saying, you get into a room, you think something's going on, you're looking for the adult in the room, all around, all the other people in the room, and you realise you're the adult in the room. It's a very, very waking moment. But understandably, she's going through that moment. She's thinking to herself, everybody else seems to have the shit together, and I am struggling. My life's falling apart, theirs is all coming to fruition. And he's like, that's not true. You don't need to run away from your problems. You can face them. And he says, that's what we'll do. We can sort this out. You know, he gets together the scenario that means that she's got something to cling on to. And he says, we'll get you reinstated. Now, in one way, this is amazing. Stephen's being supportive. He's helping her future focus. He's doing all the right things as a good parent. But equally, she knows how far down this road she's gone. He is hearing this for the first time in this moment. So he's not thinking about all the collateral damage that she's done and the fact that she's been living a life for a period of time. So this is probably quite scary for Sydney. Obviously, it's exactly the right thing to do where Stephen is concerned. But for Sydney, she's probably thinking, oh my God, they're going to find out more and more and more and more. And we already know what a struggle she's having in facing the truth herself. Stephen calls his wife, Brenda. He says that Brenda's basically better at dealing with these kind of things than he was. And also that Brenda's line of work meant that she was really good in diffusing emotional situations. He then goes back to work as Brenda, being the positive, amazing mother, starts to get home, gets on her way to see Sydney to start resolving this scenario. But in between, we obviously have Sydney in a scenario where things are starting to collapse. She's spoken to her father. She's probably held back some of the information that would make perfect sense. We always like to drip feed negativity. And she's now about to face mum. And we already know from what Dad said that mum's more of the emotional person. She's the person who can sort things out. But that means she's probably more of a confronter. And she's somebody who's going to be very comforting to Sydney, but also is going to want to dig deep and figure out, what are we dealing with, Sydney? What do I need to think about before I call the university, and so on and so forth? So when Brenda arrives home and obviously starts to confront this issue, the school administrators from Mount Union School actually phone Brenda. So they were actually returning her call to discuss Sydney's academic performance. So obviously Brenda is being in touch, figuring out where are we, what we're doing, what's happening, what do I need to know. She's probably realised that Sydney has been lying to her to a degree that she's even at this point not ready to completely confront. So Brenda wants to get ahead and figure out what she needs to be dealing with for her daughter, and also regarding the truth that needs to be told so they can really get to the roots of what needs to change. Now, whilst on the phone, that person calling, the school administrators, they hear what sounds to be like thudding sounds, and then they're hearing yelling and screaming, and then the call just cuts dead. the school officials are so concerned about this that they actually call the police. And how many times do I cover on this channel people not doing things like that? I mean, come on, what amazing people to hear something and to be like, what's that? That sounds a little bit left field. I'm actually going to...
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Call the authorities. A lot of people don't do that, but they do. So around 1 p.m. that day, emergency services respond to the call about what they've been informed could be a potential struggle inside the Powell household. And wow, it is really upsetting to watch footage of this, because when they arrive, they find Sydney absolutely hysterical and they find Brenda unconscious, and she is severely injured with multiple and sadly fatal stab wounds. The first instinct is, of course, to get Brenda to hospital, and then they're trying to figure out what on earth has happened here. This is a suburban environment. This is a completely left-field kind of crime to happen in this situation. There seems to be this young girl who's already present. What has happened? And Sydney tells the police, listen, I heard this noise, and then my mother tells me to run, so then I ran, but then I could hear this screaming, so I went back, and I found my mum like this, wounded on the floor. And then after she's kind of given this information and she's been totally hysterical, and she really is hysterical, Sydney just becomes catatonic and unresponsive. She just lies on the floor in a fetal position. So she's gone from communicating what happened to completely shutting down.
Oh my God!
What happened? What's going on? What's going on?
We heard a bang. We heard a bang, and she told me to get out, and then I heard screaming, so I came back, and she was on the ground.
Now, one thing I will say about hearing Sydney when the impact occurs, as far as the police arriving and the fallout of the situation playing out, she does sound absolutely beside herself. She really does sound absolutely hysterical, out of her mind, with respect. But equally, what we have to think about at this point is, if she's been involved in what's happened to her mother, well, she has had time to think about a backstory, to cover it up. And I wonder, when you're completely out of your mind, if that's your first port of call, to actually try to lie about a situation and fabricate it. Because if we're going to consider down the line somebody potentially saying that they're not in their right mind, you have to some degree, be in your right mind to think about a way of trying to avoid getting caught for a crime you've committed. I'm just putting it out there at this moment in time that she has got this cover story that somebody else has come in and killed her mother. Equally, one could say, well, if somebody is having a psychotic break, they could be in a dissociative state. They could carry out the actions of a murder, and they could see it as a third party being involved. And then once coming out of that psychotic state, be looking at it as if they too are a victim in this crime scene, and that they have borne witness to somebody being murdered, as opposed to the person being the murderer themselves. But the lying on the fetal position, again, we could say, well, that could be somebody in a deep state of mental decline. They've completely disengaged, again, disassociated, dealing with derealization, depersonalization, and they're just unable to move. But it could also be a way of deflecting. How do I keep the investigators at bay? I won't say anything. I'll just lie here. And by not saying anything, I can't implicate myself any further. Now, sadly, as I said, Brenda didn't make it. She died from her injuries at Cleveland Clinic in Akron General. She had been horrifically murdered. I mean, her injuries were terrible. She had been repeatedly hit over the head with an iron skillet, so you can imagine the blunt force trauma there, and then she'd been stabbed, and she was stabbed over 23 times in the neck with a kitchen knife. Now, that level of overkill tends to strike you as an intimate crime, somebody that the person knows, somebody that is rageful towards that individual, Also, the fact that the person is stabbing her repeatedly in an area where undoubtedly you are going to kill that human, it means that there is potentially a directive to wish to kill that person. But also, the overkill level is pretty astonishing, 23 times in the neck. So I guess you could bring in the idea of somebody who is just almost on autopilot, stabbing again and again and again and again in exactly the same place. They're not going all over the body, it's just one specific place. But a horrific way to die. And the case gets even more dark when the following day, in a shocking development in the case, Sydney's arrested for her mother's murder. The mother that everybody who knows Sydney says is her best friend. They're a really tight, connected, loving family, and their relationship is really special. Investigators from the get-go thought there was something really uncanny about what they were seeing. The crime scene didn't add up. It was clear that somebody hadn't broken in. It was clear that whoever had killed Sydney's mother must have had an intent to do so, and it seemed to come from a place of some kind of relational experience because of the rage that was demonstrated. And they also felt that when they arrived, Sydney's story just was not adding up. So they decide to put together in their minds what they genuinely believe played out, and that was that mother had obviously been on the phone, and then she just attacked her at this moment in time, maybe because she knew that she was talking to a place that she didn't want information passed on to, and it tripped her over the edge, and she wanted to prevent her mother hearing what was being said. So she's then accused, as top of this, of staging the crime scene and also, of course, inventing the story about the break-in. They did find that the back window had been smashed, but they said that they knew that that wasn't how anybody got in. It was just simply her smashing a window to give the impression that someone had entered the home. And actually, they'd found blood on the outside of the door near the smashed window. And that meant that the window had been broken after the attack, not before. So it just didn't add up. The trial begins on September the 7th, 2023. Now, Sydney pleaded not guilty. And she pled not guilty by reason of insanity. And we all have to be aware that in the US, it is a really high bar to be considered insane. We in the UK have a high bar also. I would say probably 9 times more you will get not guilty by reason of insanity in the UK. Genuinely, statistically, you are far more likely to get that here than in the US. They have a really high point to reach to be considered not culpable, particularly when we're talking about something as serious as murder. But her defence, they said that at the time of the murder, she was suffering from undiagnosed schizophrenia, and that she had basically killed her mother, and it had happened during a psychotic episode. And the premise of this plea is that during that psychotic break, she wouldn't understand the difference between right or wrong, and she certainly wouldn't have an understanding of the implications of the consequences of her actions. So she didn't know what she was doing to some degree, and even when she did it, she didn't realise how final those actions would be, or that she would be murdering her mother when she carried them out. Also, since she'd been arrested, since she'd been charged, she'd actually seen some really good results from treatment that she'd been receiving. They also brought in as a mitigating and very powerful factor with respect that she had absolutely no history of violence prior to the episode. So there was nobody saying, oh, she was killing cats as a child, she was setting fire to things as a child, she was beating up kids and bullying them as a child. You know, quite the contrary. You're talking about teachers giving evidence and saying Sydney was a class A student, she was amazing. You're talking about friends coming in and defending her on every level. You're talking about family members who are directly affected by the loss of this incredible woman, Brenda, her husband, so Sydney's own father, all saying Sydney is not a killer. This is completely out of character. There is absolutely no graduation to this. We can't look at an A point and think, well, that's possibility as to why we got to the B point. There is nothing that stands out in her life that could lead us to an idea that she had a propensity for violence, or that she could have ever carried out this kind of crime without something truly bizarre happening to her, or truly destabilizing, in this case, mental illness, to lead us to the point that we're at now. But prosecutors, they say, listen, you're saying that she was out of her mind. You're saying that she's dealing with a psychotic break. You're saying that she's got schizophrenia and that therefore she was unaware of what she was doing and she was unaware of the consequences. But if that's the case, how come she switched weapons? How come she went from the pan to the knife? Why would you do that? And then she had to stage the break-in. So the argument, and it's quite a powerful argument if you're on a jury hearing it, is that if you're attempting to cover up what you've done, then you must be aware that it was wrong. So Assistant Prosecutor Brian Stanham actually said, the knife just in the neck multiple times, that is purposeful. That is trying to end someone. Now, I am not going to come down on the side of knowing the ins and outs of this case more than I have watched on court TV, documents that I've read, research that I've done. Clearly, the people who were in that court know a great deal more than me. What I would say, however, is the lack of understanding around psychosis. I have lived it with my father, and I have also lived it with clients. But there is nothing more affecting, there is nothing more than empathy can grow to than being with somebody that actually lives and dies with psychosis. My father killed himself because of psychosis. So one of the things that people underestimate is how somebody with psychosis can seem at times normal, if any of us are ever normal, and yet act in ways that are inconceivably different to who they are. So I'll give you an example. My father could sit with me because I did a lot of care for him, and he and I were best friends and we were incredibly close, and I had a different relationship to anybody else in my family with my dad. And he could sit with me and he could quite rationally talk, and he could have a meal. I could do his nails, comb his hair. We could talk about fun things. We could laugh. And within 10 to 15 minutes after that, he could also tell me that my mother was stealing all of his money and that she was defrauding him of his pension. He could sit and have a conversation about things he did 15 years ago, go for a walk with me. We could have a laugh about what we were going to do at the gym. And then he could bring in the fact that it turns out he was responsible for World War III. He could also be deeply suspicious and paranoid and hide things. There are things that they can do that seem like they are completely rational in the world, and yet then they will do things that seem really almost shady. Not that he was a shady human being, that the psychosis led to him doing things because of his suspicious nature and his paranoid nature at the time. He would do things that were quite shady because he didn't trust people. So the idea that you can't conceive of covering things up when you're dealing with psychosis, the idea that you can't seem rational and be absolutely irrational beneath the surface, is just something that isn't true. You can be somebody who looks like they can figure things out and indeed seem to execute a series of tasks successfully and equally be about to go and hang themselves in a garage, which is exactly what happened in the case of my father. So what I'm trying to get across it is that I don't think we understand psychosis in the way that we should. And people have this idea that if you are insane, you cannot act in the moment with an area of deception. You cannot act in the moment by changing a scene to make it look like you've not been responsible for something you've done. You can still go through the motions of those things and not be computing reality. I'm not saying that that was what happened. I'm just trying to draw your attention to the fact that I don't really think a lot of people understand psychosis in the way that you will if you've actually lived it. And I'm sure that some of you who have psychosis, and indeed some of you who have lived with people with psychosis, can understand that too. That being said, clearly, the vast majority, and I'm talking 99.9% of people with psychosis, with schizophrenia, etc., would never kill anyone, ever, no matter what, no matter how terrible, no matter how problematic their lives are. But here we are. This is what's happened, and this is what they're trying to get across. Now, two school officials testified and said, indeed, Sydney had been suspended after the fall semester in December of 2019. She'd failed three out of the four classes that she'd taken. And when she was still attending classes and living in a dorm even after the suspension, they actually met with her to physically say to her, listen, you need to move out. But she didn't move out at this point. She just carried on living there and going through the motions until the 24th of February that year. She then told them that her parents actually knew about the expulsion. So she's telling one series of people a certain set of events have played out, and with her parents telling them another set of circumstances have played out. Now, they're the people who actually called the police after the phone call with Brenda, because they heard those thudding sounds and screaming sounds before the line cut off. And they said that what was really disconcerting is they called back a number of times and they did finally get an answer. And they thought that the person who answered, who claimed to be Brenda, actually was Sydney. And one of them actually went as far as to say, "Sydney, I think this is you. This is not Brenda." And the line went dead. So she was playing at being Brenda to try to deflect what had just occurred, because clearly Sydney would know that they'd heard all of that commotion and would have drawn attention to the situation. Also, they bring in Sydney's roommate, Lauren. She'd been best friends with her since high school. And Lauren said that she genuinely hadn't realised anything had been wrong with Sydney. She believed that she was acting really normal. She was really bubbly, even the day before the murder. What she knew was that Sydney's access key hadn't worked at one point. And Lauren said that it's really sad what had played out, because Sydney worked really hard at her studies. She didn't get drunk. She didn't party. And on one level, I guess we could say, well, it's just because Sydney wasn't any good at the course that she was doing academically. She was struggling. But it could also be that if she's going into a state of mental decline, things that would ordinarily be quite simple become very complex. It's not that the person can't appear normal, but if they're dealing with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, psychosis, etc., you are gonna be dealing with the world in a very different way. You know how you're meant to act, but you have all these other things going on in your mind that means that computing certain simple tasks or learning new pieces of information, it would be like learning Chinese when you have no skill for languages. So it could be that it's Sydney's mental health and mental illness that's coming to the forefront, which is preventing her from succeeding. Now, the lead investigator in the case, a guy called Dave Whidden, he said that Sydney's phone had been taken into evidence. And again, of course, the text messages are going to reiterate that she's been hiding the fact that she's dropped out from her family. We know that because she's been living this lie. But the messages seem to indicate that Brenda might have actually known that Sydney was hiding something from her. That's what mothers are like. We have intuition. Your kids can try to get away with it. You know, they can pretend they're all right, but you know they're not. You can see that they're struggling. It's just something about bringing them into this world and bringing them up. They have ways of being that even the air of their emotional change is enough to alert you. And she'll be looking at the habits of a daughter and the mood of a daughter, and she's clearly aware that something is wrong with Sydney. So in messages from the 25th of February 2020, Brenda had been alerted by that app, the Life 360 app, that Sydney was at home. And she texted her daughter to say, "Look, have you got any afternoon classes?" And Sydney replied that she didn't. She said that the teacher had gone on holiday and that they'd just been given online lessons and a worksheet in her absence. But later that day, Brenda had actually texted asking, "Why do I always feel that you're scamming me? Just remember that you need the grades for your scholarships." And Sydney had then replied, "Yes, I know my grades are good, thank you very much." So Brenda did obviously intuitively know that something wasn't right. But again, even though she thinks that her daughter's scamming her, and she's clearly letting her daughter know, "I'm onto something here, I'm worried," she's not pressing her. She's not being nasty towards her. Brenda is obviously, you know, somebody who cares deeply for her daughter, wants the best for her, but also doesn't want to make her feel threatened, doesn't want to make her feel inferior, and doesn't actually challenge her further. Now, when it came down to what this case is about regarding whether she's guilty of murder or whether she is actually somebody who's dealing with a mental health issue that's led to the killing, therefore she's not guilty, there are a lot of conflicting reports from psychologists. I mean, there always are. I mean, it's the way it goes. I always kind of think it's a bit embarrassing for psychologists and psychiatrists in court, because one goes, "It's this," the other goes, "No, it's not." So I always think that we don't do a great service to ourselves as independent reporters, because we kind of disagree with one another a lot of the time. And if we're disagreeing with one another, are we saying that we don't understand our field? Are we saying that one person's right, one person's wrong? Two truths can't exist. It has to be a truth or a lie. the person either is or isn't. So we're in a case where that kind of thing happens. So the psychologists regarding Sydney's mental state at the time of her attack do disagree at times. I would say the majority do believe that she'd experienced psychosis, but not all of them agree. So the prosecution pointed to the analysis of Dr. Sylvia Obradovich. She interviewed Sydney for over 2 hours and she came to the conclusion that she was malingering. So malingering is a fancy word for faking it. People will say, no, it's not necessarily about faking it. It's more about exaggerating symptoms. No, it's about faking it. If somebody says this person's malingering, you're like, oh, you're hypochondriac of the biggest level. And it's a word that nobody wants to have associated with them when we're thinking about a case like this. You know, Sydney isn't going to want people to think that she's exaggerating it or faking illness to avoid full responsibility. She wants people to hear that she's struggling. Now, what this doctor did was diagnose her with borderline personality traits and anxiety disorder. Personality disorders are always an interesting one, particularly borderline personality disorder, because it's one of those that encapsulates so many different issues. But again, when you look at somebody like Sydney and her life, BPD is not necessarily one that you would connect with because she hasn't had a really traumatized past. She's had a very loving environment, and often BPD is formed through trauma and the response to trauma, and yet it doesn't seem to necessarily fit with this girl's past history. Whereas when you think about something like schizophrenia, which is a brain disease to some degree, arguably that can come from just a moment and period of stress, and you may never have had any issues growing up. You might have come from the best family ever, and then boom, it happens. So I would say it's more in line that they're diagnosing schizophrenia than BPD. But again, Dr. Sylvia is working for the prosecution. So Dr. Sylvia believed that Sydney's motive for the attack was that she didn't want her parents to be disappointed in her. I totally understand that that was the motive for the attack. And again, this is where people get lost, where psychosis comes in. If you are psychotic, it doesn't mean that you cannot understand why you were acting in a moment. It's just that the understanding of that moment is completely distorted. So it could well be that she did believe that she needed to kill her mother because she didn't want her to find out the truth, but she acts in a completely irrational way in managing that situation. So she ultimately kills her mother to just stop her in that moment finding out something that she doesn't want her to hear in that moment, without realizing that ultimately that moment will end her life. So you can know what your motive is for the attack, I don't want mum to know, and attack her not actually wanting to kill her. That is quite possible. In fact, that would be considered quite probable where these kind of psychotic breaks occur. Now, the defence, they call on the opinion of Dr. Robin Belcher Tim. And he proposed that Sydney had a psychotic episode, which began unravelling when she was made to leave her university accommodation. That this was the moment where she started to really lose connection with reality, and the delusion became bigger and bigger and bigger and more unmanageable. And they went on to say that she basically became more and more out of touch with reality during the time. This is when she was living in hotels and trying to carry on that delusion that's becoming more and more problematic. And he believed that at the time of the attack, she didn't understand how wrong her actions were, and that he definitely didn't believe that she was malingering. Another doctor, Dr. Anthony Smartnick, who treated Sydney after the attack on her mother, also argued that he didn't think she was malingering. He diagnosed her with schizoaffective disorder. Also said she had symptoms of PTSD as she had graphic nightmares after the murder. So basically, as she starts to come to terms with the gravity of her actions and the fact that she now no longer has a mother because she's murdered her brutally, that connects her to the trauma of the killing, and she's having those symptoms of flashbacks and nightmares and the things that we would expect when somebody's endured a really traumatic experience. And there is this idea that there is either a black or white in this scenario, i.e. she either is mentally unwell and therefore completely competent, and because she's tried to cover up the crime, because she took the phone call and pretended to be a mother, because she killed her in such a brutal fashion and tried to cover it up, therefore she is absolutely competent and she is in charge of her faculties, as opposed to the white, which is she is completely insane, she had no idea of what she was doing, and therefore she just killed her mother, but respectfully, the idea would be that she wouldn't have gone and done all the things that I just said in the black version of events where she covers it all up, you know, which is why the grey area is the problem, because they're like, oh, it's not entirely white because she did all those things in the black. But the grey area is really where everything exists. The grey area with psychosis is that she could indeed have an understanding of wishing to not be found guilty for this attack that she's carried out, because she realises that the consequences of her actions are grave, even though she may not be computing that she's murdered her mother. She knows suddenly, coming to her senses to some degree, that what has happened is terrible and tragic, and that she's potentially the person who's the antagonist in this situation, but she has no reasoning in her mind as to why she went ahead and did that. And it was such a spontaneous event without premeditation or planning that in that panic, she comes to that point where she just tries to figure out how to cover up her actions because she's so out of her mind. It is possible to go through what I've just said. It's not black and white. You can want to cover something up when you are psychotic. It doesn't go down the line of somebody who is psychotic would never do A, B, or C. That's not how psychosis works. In fact, psychosis is so out there and so completely atypical to human behaviour that that's why it's impossible to imagine that you can draw those conclusions and those straight lines and that black and white belief system. So this particular doctor who's talking about the post-trauma, he actually prescribed it with antipsychotic medication, and that is not nice to be on. Gonna tell you, you put on a lot of weight a lot of the time. It can be quite challenging to be on that medication, but understandably, it can also at times, not always, but at times be effective. And it's clearly being effective for her, which would indicate that the diagnosis is correct. Dr. Thomas Swale, he believed that she was also experiencing a psychotic episode when she killed her mother. And one of the reasons behind that conclusion was the apparent lack of motive for the attack, because it just seemed to be unnecessarily brutal as well, and didn't actually lead to any positive outcome. So arguably saying that Sydney's in charge of her mind and is killing her mother to avoid her finding out, well, the ramifications and conclusions and consequences of her killing her mother are far graver than being found out that she's not at university anymore. So again, that would be a more insane reaction. To actually kill somebody to stop them finding out something that eventually is going to lead to you potentially being in prison for a long period of your life. So that conclusion that he came to was the apparent lack of motive for the attack. And he diagnoses her with schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type. So again, that would be marked by the manic and depressive episodes that also plays into the schizoaffective disorder. Then we've got Dr. James Reardon. He concluded that she lost a grip on reality in the 3 months prior to the attack and basically wasn't capable of reasonable thought. He said that the failings at university just didn't align with the way in which she viewed herself. So she just basically created an alternative reality. And Sydney had told that particular doctor that she only remembered flashes of the attack, and that her final memory of her mother, in that memory, she was just receiving comfort from her as they sat on the couch. And it also really interests me that the last core memory that she has with her mother is of them sitting together on the couch and her mother is comforting her. Now, some could say, well, that's just her trying to create a cover story that her mother was being really nice to her, which then plays into that, well, if her mother was being really nice to her, why on earth would she kill her? But that core memory could also be there because that was where she was feeling a safe space. That was where the psychosis was present, but where she was feeling soothed in the presence of somebody that loves her. And then the phone rings. And bear in mind, she in that moment is feeling safe. She in that moment is feeling that her mother is understanding, and she'll be withholding certain amounts of information. She'll be drip feeding that information because she doesn't want to let people down. And then the phone goes and the mother answers the phone and she starts to hear, and maybe she gives her a look because she's hearing information, as many of us would do if we were in a situation where our child has told us one thing and the university is telling us another. And that could have been something that in that moment, Sydney just wants to stop. She doesn't want her mother to hear anymore. And that's when she snaps. So that's where the psychosis plays out in the most catastrophic way. She'll do anything to stop her mother hearing those words, even if ultimately that means her mother never hears anybody's words again. It's grotesque. It's an escalation of the highest level. But Would it make sense, if she was sane, when she'd been comforted by her mother moments earlier, to act in this way unless she was going through this kind of episode? Now we get to September the 20th, 2023, and Sydney is found guilty of the murder of her mother. She's also found guilty of felonious assault and tampering with evidence. And when it came down to the sentencing, she was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison.
Ms. Powell, is there anything you want to say to me at this time? Okay.
I have advised Ms. Powell that given the nature of her appeal, she should not make a statement.
And I understand that, but I have to give her the opportunity to do so. All right. Thank you very much. First of all, to the victims, to the family and friends, I am terribly sorry for your loss here. I cannot imagine what you have been through. I have received and read all of the letters that have been sent to me. I have considered the evidence that was brought into evidence at the trial, the statements of counsel, and all of the information that is before me at this time. I do find that counts 2 and 3 merge with count 1 for purposes of sentencing in this matter. Based upon the facts and circumstances of this case and in consideration of the relevant sentencing factors, including seriousness and recidivism, and applying the minimum sanction that the court has determined will protect the public and punish the offender without imposing an unnecessary burden on state and local resources, the court imposes the following sentence. On count 1, ma'am, I sentence you to an indefinite sentence of 15 years to life in the Ohio Department of Corrections. On count 4 of the indictment, I sentence you to 3 years in the Ohio Department of Corrections. Those two sentences to be run concurrent with and not consecutive to each other. Ma'am, please understand that on count 4 of the indictment, you may be subject to a period of post-release control upon your release. And if you violate that post-release control, the Adult Parole Authority is authorized to return you to prison for up to 9 months for any single violation and up to 50% of your prison sentence for all violations. Please also understand that if you're placed on post-release control and you are convicted of a new felony, in addition to being punished for that offense, the judge could add an additional consecutive 1 year period of time in prison, whichever is greater as a maximum. Ma'am, understand that you have a right to appeal this decision and that notice of appeal must be filed within 30 days of the sentencing judgment entry. Your attorney has indicated to me that you are without funds to hire an attorney to represent you for appeal. Is that correct? And you wish for me to appoint counsel to represent you?
Yes, sir.
All right. I will do that. We will try and get that done before you leave the Summit County Jail. Ma'am, I will not fine you. I will not assess you court costs in this matter. Counsel, is there anything that I have forgot?
I neglected to do this earlier, and I apologize. We appreciate the court's deference to Ms. Powell and the opportunity to allow her to leave during certain portions of the trial. I know that it is rather unprecedented, but we would appreciate the court's compassion in allowing that during this trial. Thank you.
Thanks for necessary.
Good luck to you, Ms. Powell. Thank you. We're adjourned.
All rise. Now, what's intriguing about this case is that Sydney's family had actually asked for a lenient sentence for Sydney. This was all the way throughout. This is from the get-go. They were saying, we don't want her in prison. And Sydney's attorney, Donald Malarkic, he had actually commented that her family would love and support her no matter what. He got really emotional, actually, when he was doing his closing argument, his closing statements. He was basically really moved by what had happened. Her father, Stephen, who never wavered in his support for his daughter at all and still hasn't, he wrote a letter to the Summit County Court of Common Pleas in which he said that Sydney's sentence was not justice for Brenda and that it is not what she had wanted for her daughter. He wrote that, quote, since there can never be true justice in this case, Sydney's mental health should be our main priority. It is, when you think about this, really amazing that her family are being so supportive, because many people would see that only serving 15 years is lenient. Bear in mind, maybe if we were dealing with a young person who came from a dysfunctional family, who'd had some behavioural difficulties growing up because of their environment and their treatment by people around them. If they'd got themselves involved in small petty crime, if they were in a situation where they were living by themselves and didn't have a job, and then they murdered a parent in an apparent psychotic break, I doubt very much the leniency would exist in the way that it exists in this case. I think that the judgment could have been far harsher with respect, but I equally understand that the family who know and love Sydney have a bias regarding who she is as a human being and therefore wish for her to be free and ultimately want to support her in that plea for freedom. There were a lot of letters, I would say, that were in support of Sydney, came from family members, as well as community members, including actually a doctor who'd worked with Brenda. So people who were genuinely invested in Brenda and genuinely would have a right to feel absolutely devastated by a passing and feel very rageful and think that somebody has to pay, they all seem to be on the side of Sydney. It seems as if they can't digest that Sydney is a killer. They need to see her as somebody who genuinely was mentally incompetent and was unaware of her actions to such a degree that she isn't culpable of this crime. Now, Brian Loprinzi, that was the chief of the Summit County Criminal Division, he said, the law does not require us to succumb to the wishes of the victim's family. Now, of course, Sydney's family are going to appeal this, but I do understand that statement. We understand as a family, you want Sydney to be free. We understand as a family, you think you know her better than we know her. We understand as a family, you feel that Brenda would wish for her daughter to be free. But the problem is that they don't understand as a family the way the law works. They don't understand as a family the importance of a legacy for Brenda, because justice needs to be served for her, even though she would have loved her daughter, even though I'm sure she would wish for her daughter to have a life where she survives and thrives. The truth is, Brenda, in spite of that feeling towards her daughter, still matters. And therefore, the chances are that Sydney will walk free at some point, that Sydney will potentially have a life and a family and a job and a future, and one drenched in the love of the people who adore her and support her in spite of her actions. But we equally need to recognise that a life was lost. A woman was brutalised and executed in the most hideous of fashion by her own flesh and blood. And somebody has to pay a price for that. Even if that's something that we do and it feels a little bit unfair. I'm not saying that Sydney doesn't deserve what she's getting. I'm saying it feels a little bit unfair because the family want a different outcome. We have to remember that that's why the law is neutral. The law comes in to make judgments where others would choose not to judge. I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Obviously, I've introduced a bit of my own personal story because I understand psychosis in a very different way than most people do. And I say that not to seem egotistical or superior or arrogant. I'm not. My dad killed himself. So you don't get any superiority or arrogance when you've been through that. And it was me who cut him down. I understand this area more than most people will ever understand it, more than any psychiatrist will understand it, unless they happen to have lost in the way that I've lost. What I'm trying to do is bring in the fact that most people don't get what psychosis is like. And psychosis can affect quite a few different mental health issues. So, you know, you can have different mental illnesses and experience psychosis. In fact, you can go through a period of psychosis and never have had a period of mental health issues or mental illness. So it's one of those things that can occur momentarily, a psychotic break. I know somebody, for example, whose father never was ill, had a psychotic break for about 15 minutes, threw himself in front of a train. Boom, over. So psychosis is not a well-understood thing, process, illness. But I have an unusual insight I'm grateful for, I really am grateful for. And I hope that in telling you my story and also interjecting the areas that I think relate to Sydney's story, that you might have come away with a deeper and more connected understanding with why this case is a conflicting one.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.